Okay, this should be a real quick one. This is about what's his name? Thomas Wentworth Higginson's text, Black Rebellions, which goes through five different rebellions, two or three of which are tightly connected with particular physical places and the practice that is called marinage, which people give different etymologies from, and Higginson's gives you one of them. But the practice of marinage, like that term comes from the period of enslavement of Africans, particularly in the Caribbean and then in North America. And it's a term that was used in a kind of specific way. They'd talk about petit marinage, like little running away, meaning that slaves would sometimes take off for a day or two. And this was possible because of a basic and extensive understanding of the physical world that was around them, how they could hide, how they could get away without being seen, stuff like that. And then there's grand marinage, big running away, which meant that slaves took off indefinitely. And in some of the key places, maybe in all the key places, but in some notable circumstances like Haiti, Jamaica, Suriname, the Great Dismal Swamp in the eastern seaboard of the U.S., these runnings away led to the construction of totally autonomous, separate communities, which were free from the slave system that they ran away from. And they have all kinds of interesting properties. They tend to be, on the one hand, rooted within traditions that are not derived from the slave-owning, slaving colonialist culture, but instead rely upon African traditions, African languages, and African religion. But on the other hand, they seem to be very open and porous. And a lot of these, like in Haiti, for example, some of the Maroon communities actually involved a lot of poor white folks who were brought to that island as indentured servants and who rejected that. And so there's, on the one hand, this kind of like, you know, resurgence of the cultures that were left behind and that were then attacked so thoroughly by colonization. There's the resurgence of older practices, but there's also an openness to experimentation and hybridization of practices. These are features of marinage. So basically, I just gave you this text as, you know, sort of a reference point for the beginning of what is called the Black Radical Tradition, which comes out especially of thinkers from the Caribbean and comes out of an experience of slavery. You know, the perspective, the relationship to freedom and liberation clearly is going to be different for enslaved people than it is for non-enslaved people or for the slavers themselves, right? And I think it's important to recognize that what constituted freedom, for example, for the Jamaican Maroons in the passage that I gave you, was not just getting away from the Spanish slavers and then the potential English slavers who later conquered Jamaica. It was premised on that. That was a condition of possibility. Although if you check out that Roberts text, he'll try to show you different ways in which marinage operates in place, which I think is kind of clever, but I don't know, a little too abstract for my taste or something. Lots of people write about marinage theoretically now. But for those, for Cujo's people, for those slaves on Jamaica who ran away, running away was a precondition for the establishment of a free life, but it wasn't all there was to be said about it. It's not just that they got away from the plantation and, you know, lived in some kind of like stereotypically backwards fashion in the mountains. No, they lived in a very specific fashion in the mountains. So these are basic things that I want to point out. And this is the kind of stuff I hoped would exist in Roberts, but I guess it really exists more in like Laurent Dubois writes about Haiti. C.L.R. James touches on this stuff in his famous book on Haiti, on the Haitian Revolution, The Black Jacobins. The Laurent Dubois book that I know about this, but he writes a couple of others, is Avengers of the New World, which is a history of Haiti, largely derivative of C.L.R. James. And then James C. Scott, in The Art of Not Being Governed, talks a lot about these basic things. And I like those texts because they are texts concerned with the logistics of revolution. And what are the things that make revolution, or at least the movement towards autonomy on the part of a people clearly, previously, heteronomously, or, you know, externally controlled enslaved people, clearly externally controlled. What are the real processes and the real characteristics of their becoming free, full, self-determining people? And the basic thing I would say, I mean, first of all, recognize that, as I said, Marinage, running away, but not just running away, also then constructing autonomous communities, happened pretty much wherever there was slavery. I mean, I don't know this history very well, but I have some friends who have been mentioning it to me. The situation of the Garifuna, who you might see referenced in the news today, because Garifuna leaders have been disappeared by a government that is just serving the interests of big developers in Honduras specifically. There's also a large population of Garifuna in Belize. They have a similar origin. They're escaped slaves. They didn't just run away. They ran away and they established their own thing. And their own thing was, I would say, premised on two or three important aspects, you know, things that we have to keep in mind if we want to understand freedom in a full, positive, and concrete sense. One is that freedom is facilitated by particular places, but not by other places. If you check out that James C. Scott book, which is one of my favorites, one reason I didn't put it in this class is because I use it so much in my other ones. It's called The Art of Not Being Governed. It looks at Zomia in particular, which is a name for a large region in Southeast Asia overlapping seven or eight nation states, which Scott will say is the longest ungoverned place on the face of the earth. One of the points that he makes in that book is that, you know, nation-state structures, or state structures, even from the beginning of so-called civilization, which is really not that long ago compared to the overall history of the human species, we weren't always hierarchical creatures. That's only, like, you know, 1% of our history, really. But those state structures, whether we're talking about in Asia or in Mesopotamia or in Peru, those structures emerged on plateaus, usually in valleys, in the Andes, in high plateaus, but places that were open. These are places where human bodies are easily coerced. These are places where military machines have an easy time operating. The places that were always free longer, and you can find this all over the world. So, you know, look at Northern Africa, and the more open spaces towards the Mediterranean are the places where colonization in multiple waves happened from the Roman world through the Arab world to the present. And the mountains, like the mountains of Algeria, are places where people lived more freely and in so-called barbaric and tribal ways for much longer. This is where the Maroons went as well. They went to the mountains. The mountains have a history of sheltering freedom. Now, this might seem trivial. It might seem like a passing thing, but I really don't think it is, because if we want to establish freedom, if we want to think about how can we make freedom, maybe we also have to think about the spaces that we're in and the practices that we take part in. In fact, maybe there's no such thing as freedom in a real way outside of a real space and a real time. Put this another way. Think about, say, the refugee camps or think about the Gaza Strip. This is a place where Palestinian militants were able to shelter themselves for long periods of time. And when the Israelis have attempted to suppress intifadas or otherwise control Palestinian territory, they had to demolish a lot of these camps because the camps were set up in such a fashion. Or think about the Battle of Fallujah. It's all about this. Set up in such a fashion that they were very confusing. There are a lot of pathways. The spaces are very close, and so they lend themselves to ambush. Secret hiding places are easy to produce. So it's not just about natural formations. We can have architectural formations too. You know, there can be constructions by people which are set up intentionally to make state power, which requires surveillance, which requires lines of sight, which requires large space for movement of large bodies. Or the Battle of Algiers, you know, the famous movie is based on the constructions that happened in the Kasbah, which was a large set of housing complexes where this happened again, where secret passageways and hiding places and corridors for movement could be constructed. They made it into a fortress, and then they got rid of everybody who was going to rat them out as best they could, right? This has to do with taking control of a space and changing that space in such a fashion that it is capable of repelling people who would like to come and coerce you. In Jamaica, of course, the example is the cockpits, these canyons and mountains where Cujos, Maroons, and then the generations afterwards were able, first of all, to get away from Spanish slavers and then stand them off. And there's like, if you wanted to go back, there's kind of like a master-slave thing going on here. I mean, in the Hegelian sense, as well as in the literal sense, where the Spanish masters became weaker than the African slaves on whose work they depended. And eventually, once those slaves get a foothold for themselves, they become a military force, which is overwhelming to the Spanish. They just cannot dislodge this Maroon population. They go to the mountains because the mountains afford protection, because the mountains afford hiding places, because they afford covert travel, because they afford the capacities of ambush. Not all spaces are the same. Not all places are the same. We need to tune into the places where we are and think about what in those places facilitates autonomy, self-determination, and what in those places facilitates or is a part of heteronomy, external determination. I think this is cool stuff to think about. And by the way, you know, you should also know that, like, you know, the African people have a history of being profoundly capable warriors, right? In the story about Jamaica, we see the only people who were capable of even approaching the Maroon encampments were other black troops or indigenous troops. The white people couldn't do it. First the Spanish and then the English take over Jamaica, but they can't get the Maroons out of the hills either. Even with their artillery, they can't get them out of the hills. The best that they can do is come to a treaty. And so by their, first of all, their flight, which involves defiance, which involves, like, you know, the continuation of freedom, even in circumstances of great constraint, that's really important. Some slaves would not run. And this, you can come back to this and think about this with Malcolm X, right? Maybe especially the slaves who, in one way or the other, became a little bit privileged in that slave system. They have the least incentive to run. But actually, even though they're the ones who get to wear the master's clothes and hang out in the master's house, maybe they're actually the least free of the slaves. And the ones who are put in shackles more regularly, beaten more regularly, but retain some degree of defiance and actually are willing to take the risks in order to plot to escape or to revolt. Like in Haiti, they got together and they plotted and then they rose up and they killed all the white people and took the island for themselves, right? That came from the most beaten down portion of the population, not from the house slaves, but from the field slaves, not from the ones who had it kind of okay, but from the ones who were beaten regularly. Although Toussaint Louverture was closer to the master's house, and that afforded possibilities for him too, specifically possibilities to understand the overall political situation and to think about things like military strategy. Anyway, so they start with this urge to freedom, to liberation in a sort of negative sense, but then they start moving into a positive dimension of freedom where they root themselves in a particular place. And then let's add to this, there's a resurgence of something that the slavers very much attempted to beat out of African people entirely, but failed to beat out of them, and that is their own languages, their own religious practices, their own forms of exchange and cohabitation. So as Cujo's folks organize themselves in the mountains, they don't do it according to the European standard. This is not to say that the European standard or other circumstances around them didn't influence them. Of course, they do. We none of us can escape being influenced. But they primarily went back to African religious practices. And so Cujo is not only the military leader of this particular group of Maroons, and there were many in Jamaica, but he was also the religious leader. This is true in the Haitian Revolution as well, that the military leaders were also religious leaders. And those religions are specifically African religions. So at the beginning of the Haitian Revolution, Dadi Boukman supposedly did this speech with lightning and thunder going on in the background, the secret gathering of slaves. And they're all secret gatherings for religious purposes where these plans were made. The revolution was steeped in so-called voodoo. And he tells everyone, look, you got to kill off the white man's god. You got to get rid of the white god and go back to the African deities, and they will give you the power to overcome this oppression. And they did. So it's not just rooting in place. There are particular places which are conducive to freedom and defense and autonomous spatial control. Certainly there are. I mean, all military people know this. You want to achieve tactical advantage. High ground is better than low ground. You want a water supply. These are real things to really be thought about. But also there are cultural practices which are useful and ones that are not. And especially if you have been given a culture which has been imposed upon you, that culture in a lot of ways is operating to inhibit the growth and the flourishing of your capacities. You know, if you are a Mexican person, like many Mexican people, who has been Catholicized, you've been made into a Catholic, there's an aspect of that doctrine which has to do with you believing in your own guilt. And there's even, you know, depending on where you're at, representations of the white or at least the light Jesus, which operates as a model that makes the darker folks and the more indigenous folks feel less like what they are, what they ought to be. And there are positive aspects too, right, where indigenous Mexican, Mexica, Yaqui, Mayan traditions find their way into Mexican Catholicism such that actually it's secretly a combination of these things. Okay, so I just wanted to say that, like, take a look at this. Know that there is this, you know, noble and rebellious history to enslaved Africans, which was very dangerous. You know, like, Higginson himself was a white guy who was like a Unitarian transcendentalist sort of, well, he's an abolitionist, too radical for everybody that he came into contact with. But he was intentionally propagating these stories because they had themselves a liberatory capacity. The slave owners in North America, in the South, had to be very careful. They were really worried about their slave populations getting wind of what was going down in Haiti or understanding what really existed in terms of Maroon rebellion and Maroon communities. And depending on who those slave populations were, they might understand these things more or less. Actually, let me add one thing. Pages 13 to 15 in this text, I think, offer a beautiful picture of what a free life might be like. So here is how the Maroons in Jamaica lived. Among the wild mountains of Jamaica, the Maroons dwelt in a savage freedom. So healthful and beautiful was the situation of their chief town that the English government has erected barracks there of late years as being the most salubrious situation on the island. They breathed in an air 10 degrees cooler than that inhaled by the white population below, and they lived on a daintier diet so that the English epicures used to go up among them for good living. The mountaineers caught the strange land crabs plodding in companies of millions their sidelong path from mountain to ocean and from ocean to mountain again. They hunted the wild boars and prepared the flesh by salting and smoking it in layers of aromatic leaves, the delicious jerked hog of buccaneer animals. They reared cattle and poultry, cultivated corn and yams, plantains and cocos, guavas and papaws and mamies, and avocados and all luxurious West Indian fruits. The very weeds of their orchards had tropical luxuriance in their fragrance and in their names, and from the doors of their little thatched huts they looked across these gardens of delight to the magnificent lowland forests, and over those again to the faint line of far-off beach, the fainter ocean horizon, and the illimitable sky. They had senses like those of American Indians, tracked each other by the smell of the smoke of fires in the air, and called to each other by horns, using a special note to designate each of their comrades and distinguishing it beyond the range of ordinary hearing. They spoke English, diluted with Spanish and African words, and practiced obeyer rites quite undiluted with Christianity. Of course, they associated largely with the slaves, without any very precise regard to treaty stipulations, sometimes brought in fugitives and sometimes concealed them, left their towns and settled on the planters' lands when they preferred them, but were quite orderly and luxuriously happy. During the formidable insurrection of the Coromantan slaves in 1760, they played a dubious part. When left to go on their own way, they did something toward suppressing it, but when placed under the guns of the troops and ordered to fire on those of their own color, they threw themselves on the ground without discharging a thought. A shot. Nevertheless, they gradually came up into reputable standing. They grew more and more industrious and steady, and after they had joined very heartily in resisting D'Estaing's threatened invasion of the island in 1779, it became the fashion to speak of our faithful and affectionate Maroons. So maybe one last thing to add there. I mean, I like that as a picture of freedom, right? And especially the idea that if you live in a particular way, maybe your capacities are different. You know, maybe there are capacities, you know, capacities of hearing, capacities of smell. And then the knowledge that in this account the Maroons have of the topography where they are. It's not just that they live in the mountainous region. It's that they know it thoroughly. They're very tightly connected to their land. Perhaps if you live in a particular way, your capacities develop more fully. You know, living healthy and being free seem somehow to be connected. And the last thing I would add is that because this rooting existed both in the hills and in a certain healthy, native, deep-rooted lifestyle, the Maroons were then capable of operating in greater and stronger ways with respect to the white slaver population below them. Specifically, what happens here in Jamaica, and also what happens outward from the Maroon communities in Haiti, which are really important in the course of the revolution, although they don't quite start it, although, well, they're involved with it, they form networks. Because they have a footing, this is a military consideration, they have a footing, they have a place and a lifestyle that is self-determining and defensible. From that self-determining, defensible space and process, they are then able to reach out into the surrounding territory, which is a territory including both friends and foes. You know, the slaves are the population from which these Maroons came. They might not like all the slaves. Like, here's an example of a case where they actually fought against a certain uprising. They make their own determinations about who are going to be their allies and who not. But because they have this foothold of strength, they are capable of extending their strength into this intermediate and enemy territory, specifically by moving through that space and forming networks. Physical networks, ways of moving people and goods back and forth between the strongholds in the hills and the slave plantations themselves. This is especially true in Haiti. One of the key leaders, Macandal, before the Haitian Revolution, this is from Laurent Dubois' book, one of the fundamental things that he did was set up a poisoning network all over the island. Right? They had a knowledge of how to use plants to attack the slave owners and their cattle and their families. And then they set up physical pathways that were unknown to, or at least uncontrollable by, the slave power. Because they had a foothold elsewhere, they were able to extend networks beyond themselves. This seems to me, you know, important strategic things to think about. And then they were also able, for the same reason, to develop networks of people, and especially networks of people who would, propagate, who would give information. So you build these networks that are intelligence networks. And so, you know, the comment that Higginson makes is that Cujo and his people always knew any time an expedition was coming out towards them, such that they could always ambush them, or they could take the moment while that force was away from the lowlands to go down and carry out raids, liberate people, take goods, take weapons. They had a tactical advantage because they had their stronghold, because they had such a tight connection to the land, because they had such unalienated relationships between themselves and a certain portion of the population, because they increased their connections. They built an actual power, which was both cultural and behavioral and even spiritual, but also fully military and capable of holding space and expanding space.